The wild geese do not intend to cast their reflection. The water has no mind to receive their image. If I could sing or play an instrument for you, I would sing and play an instrument for you. If I could dance for you, I would dance for you. If I could paint for you, I would paint for you. But my thing is words. Words. But the problem about words is that you may listen to them. And that would be a mistake. For all I'm doing is painting with words. And the message that is being sent is nonverbal. Anything you write down in a notebook to take home, to think about, forget it. For in fact, I'm not going to say anything that you don't know already. But the perplexing problem is that you don't know you know. Chuang Tzu says, the fish trap exists because of the fish. Once you've gotten the fish, you can forget the trap. The rabbit snare exists because of the rabbit. Once you've gotten the rabbit, you can forget the snare. Words exist because of meaning. Once you've gotten the meaning, you can forget the words. Where can I find a man who has forgotten words so I can have a word with him? You don't have to try. You don't even have to listen. We just have to be together. And it'll all happen. It will all happen. Now, what I've just said thus far is almost heresy. For in a very obvious manner of speaking, especially since this is named after Dr. Hebb, whose research was on the human brain, we are in a temple dedicated to the worship of the rational mind. Even though God said, thou shalt take no other god but me, we did it anyway. And professors are the high priests. And here in this temple, I am saying to you that what you are seeking that is bringing you here this evening, you will not find through your rational thought processes. It's as simple as that. St. John of the Cross said, all that the imagination can imagine and the reason can conceive and understand in this life is not and cannot be a proximate means of union with God. Just won't make it. Hafiz, the poet, said, O thou who art trying to learn the marvel of love from the copybook of reason, I am very much afraid you will never really see the point. The marvel of love from the copybook of reason. We are sharing a journey at this point. What draws us together is that for the most part, we are Westerners who have experienced a set of shared experiences and who are at this point asking of themselves and that which is around them some shared questions. And it's only at the point that you ask the question that you can hear the answer. It is only at the point when it begins to dawn on you that maybe all of the methods you had available to you thus far aren't going to be enough. All we can do at this point is to share our journeys with one another. I certainly, in no even minute sense, come before you to proselytize, because the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, he that teaches those that do not want to hear is performing an immoral act. And besides, they can't hear it anyway. So it's only when, in Sanskrit they call it virag, when there is a certain amount of feeling of the falling away of worldliness, of the pull of certain things, that you're ready to hear another message. And I'm going to share with you my own experiences thus far in my journey, briefly, and try to explore some of the implications of them. As I say, the likelihood that anybody in this room will ever go my trip, wear a dress and grow a beard and become sexually continent and live in the Himalayas, that's just a trip. It's a groovy trip, but it's a trip, and it's unique to the fact that that's suitable for me at this moment. Each pilgrim on the path has to find his own way. However, all paths lead to the same place. And therefore, by hearing of other people's journeys, you can get clear as to where it is you're going, and you can get some of the dynamics of method, comparatively, perhaps. My story is a story of three chapters. The first chapter I can tell most briefly at this point in my life. It used to be the longest chapter. The second chapter is a little longer, and the third chapter is perhaps the pertinent one for the evening. Chapter one, I trained to be a social psychologist in the field of child development and personality theory. I got my PhD from Stanford, and I was a professor at Harvard. I taught at Cal and Stanford and Harvard. I came from a middle-class, upwardly mobile family. And I got my PhD primarily out of fear. And I knew when I took my doctoral exams that I didn't know, but I was very charming. And when I got to Harvard, I assumed that now that I was in one of the inner temples, I would know. And I taught HIP courses. I taught Freud and human motivation, clinical pathology. And I went to the first faculty meeting, and they had high tea at 3:30. And it was very much like being in the Virginia Assembly at the one of the historical landmarks in the United States. Even if they were talking about the hours that Radcliffe women had to be in bed, it all sounded like a high oratory out of a Greek amphitheater. And I was very awed by it, but as the time went on, I was there for 5 years, I began to see that we didn't know enough. Down the hall from me in one direction was Eric Erickson, another was Dave Reisman, Jerry Bruner of cognitive psychology, some of the people who were social scientists who supposedly knew. But it stood to reason that if we all knew, we should really be grooving. And we weren't. Life just wasn't beautiful enough. Everybody was talking about the rat race, looking drawn out in a highly competitive field. And what bothered me was I knew I didn't know. But if you look in other people's eyes to get the image of who you are, it's pretty good. And everybody kept saying, well, he's a Harvard professor, so he knows. And my mother was proud of me. And I had collected all of the symbols of success in society, or at least a large number of them. I had a Cessna airplane, and a Mercedes-Benz, and a Triumph motorcycle, and a bachelor apartment full of antiques, and I had groovy dinner parties with bouillabaisse and white wine. And I went skin diving in Nassau, and, you know, and I sat on important committees. But every now and then, just before I'd be going to sleep, or when I'd be in the bathtub or something, there'd be that moment when there wasn't somebody else's eyes to look into to tell me how wonderful I was. And I knew that it wasn't enough. It didn't make it. And tenure was being dangled before my nose if I merely got my, quote, publications in order. And I thought, well, I have 40 more years of this. And I think it is most likely that I would have gone along at that pace, just collecting more and more badges. But down the hall from me, I was a big empire builder. I had 40 research assistants and two secretaries and four offices at Harvard, and I was in four different departments. And down the hall from me, in a little closet-like room that didn't have any secretaries and nothing going, sat a man, and we became drinking buddies, and his name was Timothy Leary. And one evening, we talked about Mexico, and he said he was going to be in Mexico the next summer and invited me to visit with him. And in a drunken moment, I said, well, why don't we fly across the north of South America, because I'm a pilot. And he said, that's a great idea. So we made a plan, and I neglected to tell him that all I had was my student license. But I worked hard all spring, and I got my license the day before I left for Mexico. And it was a hair-raising trip, and I arrived at Cuernavaca, where Timothy was, and he had just ingested these mushrooms, which are called Tiananactl, or flesh of the gods. And he said he had seen more in 9 hours than he had learned in all his years as a psychologist. And there weren't any more mushrooms around. So we didn't go to South America. We hung out and talked about the mushrooms. And then we went back to the United States, and I was away. I was teaching at Cal as a visiting professor. And when I got back in the spring, one night, on the night of a large snowstorm, I was invited over to Timothy's house. I was visiting my parents in this suburb near Timothy, about a few blocks away. And I walked the few blocks to ingest psilocybin, the synthetic of the Mexican mushrooms. And after a kind of a melodramatic social scene in the kitchen over whether the dog was going to die, It's that peculiar situation you get into when you've taken a psychedelic, because the dog had been out running in the snow and was panting, and the question was he panting naturally or not, and how would we know? But Tim's young son, 11 years old, came down and set us straight. And then I went off into the living room by myself. And this is the report of that few moments at that point. But now, a few hours later, I had gone off by myself to reflect upon these new feelings and senses. A deep calm pervaded my being. The rug crawled and the pictures smiled, all of which delighted me. Then I saw a figure standing about 8 feet away where a moment before there had been no one. I peered into the semi-darkness and recognized none other than myself, in cap and gown and hood as a professor. It was as if that part of me, which was Harvard professor, had separated or dissociated itself from me. Well, I thought, I worked hard to get that status, but I don't really need it. So it's over there and I'm over here, so I'll give it up. I won't get frightened. Okay. Again, I settled back into the cushions, but at that moment, the figure changed. Again, I leaned forward, straining to see. Ah, me again. But now it was that aspect of me which was the social cosmopolite. Okay, so that goes too, I thought. Again and again, the figure changed, and I recognized over there all the different aspects I knew to be me. Cellist, pilot, etc. With each new presentation, I again and again reassured myself that I didn't need that anyway. Then I saw the figure over there become that in me which was Richard Alpert-ness. That is, the basic social identity by which I had always acknowledged my existence. Sweat broke out on my forehead. I wasn't at all sure I could do without being Richard Alpert. Did that mean I'd have amnesia? Was that what this drug that this madman had given me was going to do? Would it be permanent? Should I call Tim? What the hell? I'll give up being Richard Alpert. I can always get a new social identity. At least I have my body. But I spoke too soon. As I looked down at my body for reassurance, I could see nothing below the kneecaps. And slowly, now to my horror, with my eyes wide open, I saw the progressive disappearance of limbs and then torso, until all there was the couch on which I had sat. This is usually known as a bad trip report. A scream formed in my throat. I felt that I was dying, since there was nothing in my universe that led me to believe in life after leaving the body. Doing without professorness, or loverness, or even Richard Alpertness was okay, but I certainly needed the body. Panic mounted, adrenaline shot through my system, my mouth became dry, but along with this, a voice sounded inside, what I don't know, but inside. An intimate voice asked very quietly and rather jocularly, it seemed to me, considering how distraught I was, "But who's minding the store?" When I could finally focus on the question, which takes a while, hear it, I realized that though everything by which I knew myself, even my body and thus life itself as I knew it was gone, still I was fully aware. Not only that, but this aware I was watching the entire drama, including the panic, with calm compassion. Instantly, with this recognition, I felt a new kind of calmness, one of a profundity never experienced before. I had just found that I, Later I called it a scanning device, a point, an essence. Place where I existed independent of social and physical identity. That which was I was beyond life and death. And something else, that I knew. It really knew. It was wise rather than just knowledgeable. It was the voice inside that spoke truth. I recognized it, was one with it, and felt as if my entire life of looking to the outside world for reassurance was over. Now I need only look within to that place where I knew. Fear turned into exaltation. I ran out into the snow laughing. In a moment, the house was lost from view, but it was all right because inside I knew. At about 5:30, I walked through the silent land, the few blocks, my heart full to overflowing with the joy of my newfound self. At my parents' home, I felt the urge to clear the walk, as any good young tribal buck might. Happily, I set about the task. Then the upstairs window flew open, and there were my parents. "Come to bed, you idiot." Nobody shovels snow in the middle of the night. Ah, there was that external voice to which I had always listened. But what did the voice inside say? It said, "It's okay to shovel snow, and it's okay to be happy." I laughed up at them, danced a bit of a jig, and returned to shoveling. When I looked again, they had closed the window, and behind it, they too were smiling. It's known as a contact high. Now, the reason I read that to you at some length is because I want to read you one other thing of two paragraphs, which is an anticipation, a foreshadowing of chapter 3.